From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Dick Waterman tells some stories about the great blues musicians he rediscovered and represented. Waterman managed such performers as Son House, Mississippi John Hurt, Arthur Crudup, Buddy Guy, Junior Wells, and Bonnie Raitt. Some of the many photos he's taken over the past 40 years are collected in the new book, Between Midnight and Day, the last unpublished blues archive. Also, we talk about life in Iraq, working for a private military company. Mark Vargas is a former commander in the U.S. Special Forces, who is now a security expert for Kellogg Brown & Root in Baghdad. Vargas wrote the introduction to the new book, Hunting Down Saddam. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dick Waterman, is the only non-performer in the Blues Hall of Fame. Many great concerts and recordings would never have happened without him. In the mid-60s, after falling in love with the blues, he founded Avalon Productions, the first agency devoted exclusively to managing and promoting blues musicians. Some of the musicians who have been on his roster include Son House, Skip James, Mississippi John Hurt, Booker White, Buddy Guy, Junior Wells, and Bonnie Raitt. Waterman usually had his camera with him at concerts and ended up creating a huge archive of blues photos. Only in the past few years have they been exhibited. Now many of these photos are collected in the new book, Between Midnight and Day, the last unpublished blues archive. The book includes an introduction by Peter Guralnick and a preface by Bonnie Raitt. In the 60s, Waterman helped rediscover several important blues musicians who had vanished from public view, including Son House. Here's one of the recordings made by Son House in 1965, shortly after his rediscovery.
I went down to the station. I said I leaned up against the door. Yes, I went down to the station. And he never guessed the door. You know I know that impostor any time I hear blow. Well, I asked the deep boy, let me ride the blind, oh deep boy. Let me ride the blind. He said I wouldn't mind his son, but this impostor ain't mine. You know, he said an impostor.
Son House first recorded for Paramount Records in the 30s. Folklorist Alan Lomax recorded him in the early 40s for the Library of Congress, and that's the last his fans heard of him, until Dick Waterman and his friends Nick Pearls and Phil Spiro tracked Son House down. After searching for leads in Memphis and Mississippi, in 1964 they found Son House in Rochester, New York, a cold and snowy city in upstate New York. I asked Waterman what Son House was doing there.
Well, he had worked for the New York Central Railroad. He had moved up there probably about 1943, and he had lied about his age, making himself younger to get a job on the New York Central, and he worked on the Empire State Express, which was the train, I think it ran from New York to Chicago, and he was a porter on the train, and then he retired. He wasn't working when we found him in 64.
How did you explain to him why you were there and why you had tracked him down?
Well, we brought along a tape recorder, a reel-to-reel, and we played him some of the music of his contemporaries. We played some Charlie Patton and then Robert Johnson, who was a protege, a younger musician, and we played some of his recordings from 1930 and 1941-42. And, of course, a person doesn't hear their own voice recognizable on a recording. So he would listen to it and nod and say, "Ah, that fellow's got some of my words." And I would say, "No, no, no, that's you, that's you." And his wife came into the room and she said, "Yeah, that's you, that's you." So he listened to it and he really wasn't fascinated. He wasn't all that, it just wasn't really meaningful to him. And we told him that there were people, that there were white people who were listening to him and Robert Johnson and Charlie Patton and to some of his proteges, that some of the people that he had mentored or influenced, like Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf.
And you mentioned there was white people who were listening.
Yes, there were really very, very few people other than young white people who were young, literate, financially well off, going to Harvard or Yale or Wesleyan or Brandeis or MIT. That really was the audience. You have to understand that back in the 1960s, almost all acoustic music came under the folk umbrella. That Cajun and Zydeco and Bluegrass and Old Timey and Delta Blues, all of it was presented at folk festivals.
Did you try to convince some house to return to recording and performing?
Well, it didn't take any convincing because he was retired, he wasn't doing anything, and it was an opportunity to get out there and make some money. So, sure, he was okay with it. It was all very low-key that there was a festival in Philadelphia, so I drove up to Rochester, picked him up. We went down to the Philadelphia Folks Festival, 1964. That was actually his first comeback appearance where he played for the first time.
Did he remember his songs? And, you know, could he still sing and play?
He could still sing. Sondheim's had one of the great, great, deep, rich Delta voices of all time. He hadn't played guitar very much. So a friend of mine in Cambridge, a man named Al Wilson, who later moved to Los Angeles and was a founding member of the group Canned Heat. Al Wilson sat with Son, and they sat knee to knee with their guitars. And Al said, "This is how you played this song in 1930, and then he would play it, and Son would nod. And he said, "Then when Lomax came in the 40s, you had changed My Black Mama to My Black Woman, and this is how you played it." And Son nodded his head, and then they would play along. So really, Al Wilson taught Sondheim to play Sondheim, that there very clearly would never have been a second Sondheim career unless Al Wilson or someone very much like him brought Sondheim's recollection back.
God, that's so interesting, and it's such an interesting development that records, you know, would enable somebody to be able to do that, you know, that Al Wilson learned the Sondheim stuff through the records and then was able to subtly teach it back to Sondheim.
Really, that's true.
Yeah. So, Well, once you started to work with Sondheim, you helped him get a recording contract. And I want to play one of the recordings that came out of that. This is one that you suggested that we play. It's called Grinning in Your Face. It was recorded in 1965. It's an a cappella recording. What do you think of his singing on this recording?
It's just, I think, very, very typical of the great Delta singers, that they sang very low and very throaty, and yet there's that flared falsetto where the voice soars up into the falsetto range. He was simply a great, great singer, and that's one of the reasons that I chose this. He was a great guitarist in the 1930s and 40s. His skills did diminish after he was rediscovered in the 1960s. His hands became slower, of course, but he always had this great voice, and so I have chosen this song because I think Grinning in Your Face shows what a great singer he was.
Okay, this is Sondheim, recorded in 1965.
Don't you mind people grinning in your face? Don't mind people grinning in your face. Yeah, just bear this in mind. A true friend is hard to find. Don't you mind people grinning in your face. You know your mother will talk about you. Your sisters and your brothers too. Yes, don't care how you're trying to live. They'll talk about you still. Yes, but bear who is in mind. A true friend is hard to find. Don't you mind people grinning in your face. Don't mind people grinning in your face. Don't mind.
That's Sondheim, recorded in 1965. My guest Dick Waterman helped rediscover Sondheim in 1964. It must have been so thrilling to watch some of the original blues musicians make their comeback in the 60s. You got to do that. You got to watch that with Skip James. Tell us a little bit about Skip James before we go any further with this story, his importance in the history of blues.
He recorded for Paramount in 1931 and then just flat out vanished. That he was rediscovered in 64, but in the interim 33 years, there's really no detailed record of where he went or if he was played professional music or if he did any other recordings, that it was just an absolute total void, that he made a few sides for Paramount. And he had this high, thin, wailing voice, very, very thin. And when he was found in 64, they found him in a hospital in Tunica, Mississippi, and then they brought him to Washington for a week or two, and then they brought him to Newport in 1964. So there was a great deal of expectancy that people sat and watched him because there were bluesmen, of course, had been on the scene all along, Josh White, Brownie and Sonny, and other bluesmen such as Booker White and Mississippi John Hurt had been rediscovered before Skip. So now here comes Skip at Newport 1964, and he was coming out of the void of 33 years, and people had absolutely no idea what he would be like or what skills he had retained over the years.
That performance that you're describing was actually documented on a live from the Newport Folk Festival recording that you've brought with you. So before we hear it, is there anything else you want to say about that recording?
Well, Skip James in 1964 only knew three or four songs, so he played the three or four songs at the afternoon workshop, and it was riveting. It was charismatic. It was just stunning. That's the word. It just stunned people. And the word swept the ground. Skip James, the Negro blues singer that has just come here, he's just astounding. So the night concerts, which were very tightly programmed, they shifted around and they found 11 or 12 minutes for him that night, and he did the same songs all over again. So he just was the one that people left the festival talking about. He was absolutely riveting.
Well, here's Skip James singing Devil Got My Woman as recorded at the Newport Folk Festival in 1964.
I'd rather be the devil.
That's Skip James, recorded at the 1964 Newport Folk Festival. We'll talk more with Dick Waterman after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dick Waterman. He rediscovered, managed, and promoted many blues musicians starting in the 60s. His blues photos are collected in the new book, Between Midnight and Day. In 1965, you became an agent for blues musicians. You formed your own production company, Avalon Productions. What did you want to represent blues musicians in addition to just like rediscovering them and enjoying their music?
Well, the blues artists were the last ones hired. They would hire somebody from North Carolina, Appalachian music, bluegrass, Cajun, Zydeco. Then they'd get one of the New York Greenwich Village protests singers, or you know, Ian and Sylvia from Canada or someone like that, and then with whatever low money was left over, they would hire the blues singers, and the money being paid was just terribly, terribly low. The story that I tell in the book was that the great Robert Pete Williams, who lived in Louisiana, rode out to Los Angeles on the bus. And he played a weekend in a club for $100, sat around in someone's apartment doing nothing for 5 days, played the next weekend for another $100, and then got on the bus and drove back to Baton Rouge. And I thought that was just despicable, that I just couldn't have that happen. So I just had to step up and do something. So I rounded up 4, 5, 6 traditional blues artists. I named my company Avalon Productions for Mississippi John Hurt's hometown in Mississippi, Avalon. And I created a minimum price. And I said, I will speak for them, and this is their minimum price. I'll give you photographs, biographies, promotional material, travel itineraries. We're going to bring some degree of professionalism to this, but you're going to have to pay them much better. Then the artists themselves had to stand in loyalty to me, that they couldn't take work independently at home, that if someone called them at home for a job at low money, they had to say, no, I have an agent now, and it's Dick Waterman in Cambridge. So that really was where it started.
Some of the people you represented gave you a hard time, and one of them was Big Mama Thornton, who was known for, among other things, writing the song Ball and Chain that Janis Joplin later recorded. And you tell a really interesting story in your book about the time that Janis Joplin went to hear Big Mama Thornton. Would you tell us that story?
Well, it was a small jazz club in San Francisco, and I would say it was, I don't know, probably 1968. No, probably earlier than that, 67 or so. And I was in the club, and there were not many people in there. And Big Mama was appearing, and the door opened, and Janis and a guy came in, and there was a table right next to the stage, so they sat down. And Big Mama looked over, saw Janis, and boy, it was open season right there. And she started to say, said to Janis, and she said, now some people, they write songs, and they don't get nothing. And some people, what do those folk songs, they get themselves big houses, and they get to drive Porsche cars, and they get to sing about Mercedes Benz, but the people who write these songs, they don't get nair. And she went on and on, and Janis just sat there impassively, and Big Mama was just was doing tracks up and down. So after about 10 minutes, Janis looked at the guy she was with, nodded her head, reached into her purse, took out a $20 bill, put it on the table, got up and walked out.
Did you talk to Big Mama Thornton about that afterwards?
No, I didn't. She was really strong-minded. She was one of the most strong-minded people that I've ever met. And I work with some people who had great focus and determination. But she was some piece of work. And the idea that I might not have gotten along with her doesn't put me on any short list.
I saw her perform in Buffalo once back in the late 60s probably, and she went into a tirade in the middle of the set where she just like talked for about 10 minutes straight about how people stole things from her and didn't credit her with them.
There's a story in the book of that performance in the Mance Lipscomb essay. He was playing before her in Buffalo, and she was sitting by the side of the stage drinking out of a bottle, just wanted to get on and get her show on and get off. And Mance happened to catch that magic night where you're really in sync with the audience. And he performed, and they're demanding an encore, so he was standing by the side of the stage. And Big Mama just glared at him. And Man says, but Big Mama, they want me to go back on and do another one. So they're yelling, hollering. So Mance went on and did another encore, did a song, his first encore. And then he came off, and the crowd was yelling and screaming for more. And Mance held his guitar and looked at Big Mama, and she looked at him, and she said, you threw. And he looked at 2,000 people yelling for an encore. He looked at Big Mama, and he nodded his head. He said, you right, Big Mama, I's through.
Dick Waterman's blues photos are collected in the new book, Between Midnight and Day. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's Big Mama Thornton's 1968 recording of Ball and Chain.
Sitting by my window, Big Mama was sitting there looking at the rain. Sitting by my window, baby. Oh, I was looking out at the rain. You know, something struck me, honey. Clamped on to me like a ball.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com, and from Aveda, an earth-conscious beauty company committed to preserving natural resources and finding more sustainable ways of doing business. Information available at aveda.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, working for a private military company in Iraq, we talk with Mark Vargas, a former commander in the Special Forces, who is now a security consultant for Kellogg Brown & Root in Baghdad. He wrote the introduction for the new book, Hunting Down Saddam. Also, more blues stories from Dick Waterman. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dick Waterman. Since 1964, he's rediscovered, managed, and promoted many blues musicians. He usually had his camera with him at concerts. His new book collects many of his photos. It's called Between Midnight and Day, the last unpublished blues archive. When was the point that made you decide to give up your career as a sports writer and instead devote yourself to blues and the musicians who played it?
There was a specific night. I was managing a Chicago blues man, and we were doing a show at Notre Dame University. And my artist came in late, and he had to use borrowed equipment, and he played very badly. So the gymnasium was divided in half, half of the audience and half, well, the other half was the backstage area. So the artist came off stage, and I followed him into the corner, and I was just livid. I said, you know, you didn't come ready to play, and when you go up there, my business name goes up there. Avalon Productions goes up there. I go up there. Junior Wells goes up there. Sunhouse goes up there. We all go up there. Your triumphs are our triumphs, and your embarrassments are our embarrassments. You didn't come ready to play. So he apologized and walked away. And the guy who was the director of student programming at Notre Dame said to me, boy, that was really dumb, man. You just... you embarrassed a blues musician in front of other blues musicians. I turn around and well, there's about 15 or 20 Chicago bluesmen sitting there staring at me. So I said, well, I really screwed up. So as I was walking, someone motioned me over to the table. And I looked and it was the great Muddy Waters sitting alone. And I walked over to him, and he and I vaguely knew each other. I had rediscovered Son House, who was his mentor in the Delta many years ago. So I sat down next to Muddy, and Muddy was shuffling a deck of cards, and he looked at me, and then instead of leaning forward, he sat back in the chair, and he put his arm on the back of the chair, and he straightened up as if to address the room, and he had that wonderful cadence. He said, I heard what you said to the boy. And I seen what you did. I said, boy had it coming to him. Boy didn't show no respect for the people. Boy didn't come ready to play. Then he leaned forward and he shuffled the cards again. He put his arm back again. He said, now some folks might say you got no cause to talk to the boy that way. But you told the boy what he needed to hear. Boy had it coming to him. He said, I had my eye on you, and you just keep on keeping on, and you'll do just fine. And I got up and I walked away, and I said to myself, I can do this. I can do this management thing, and I'm not going to be a sports writer anymore. This is what I'm going to do from now on.
And that was the point where you gave up sports writing. When you were managing blues musicians, your goal was to help them make a living, and of course to make a living for yourself, but you said that you didn't see it as, you know, about history. But now that the musicians who you rediscovered and who you represented have gone, now that they're dead, do you see the work that you did as having a historic value that you didn't quite see at the time?
It always surprises people when I tell them that I don't listen to their music at home. It's more than music to me that when I hear these men, I remember their aftershave lotion. I know what they drank. I know what kind of cigarettes they smoked. I remember that I would be with them when they'd finished the song, finished the set, and they'd stand up and walk towards me, and I'd take the guitar and would step into the darkness, and they'd light a cigarette, and would turn around and would wait to see if there was enough applause for an encore. And I'd put my hand on their shoulder, and I could feel their sweat. And when I hear their music, that all comes back to me. The cigarettes, the liquor, the sound of their laughter, just talking with them, riding in a car with them. There's just so much detail there that they weren't just calm, gentle, congenial, grandfatherly men that I was very honored. I was very privileged to have had them in my life, and they took me into their lives.
Is that why you don't listen to their records at home?
That is true. That is true. Because when I listen to them, they don't come to me as musical notes. They come back to me as people.
Dick Waterman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry. I've enjoyed it.
Dick Waterman's blues photos are collected in the new book, Between Midnight and Day. Here's a track from another musician who was managed by Waterman, Mississippi John Hurt.
That lemon spoonful, I'll glance all right. That lemon spoon. My baby packed a suitcase and she went away. I couldn't let her stay with my loving, with my loving spoonful. I just had to have that loving spoon. You can bring me whiskey, you can bring me tea. Nothing satisfied me but my loving spoon or that Maxwell pal.
Coming up, working for a private military company in Iraq. This is Fresh Air. After a career in the military, serving as a commander in the Special Forces and receiving many medals and awards, Mark Vargas is in Iraq working for a private military company, Kellogg Brown & Root. In July, he became KBR's head of security in Tikrit. Now he's their security consultant in Baghdad. Kellogg Brown & Root is a subsidiary of Halliburton. On previous shows, we've discussed some of the controversies surrounding the company, but today we just wanted to hear what life is like working for a private contractor in Iraq. Vargas has written the introduction to the new book Hunting Down Saddam, written by Robin Moore. Vargas was based in Tikrit when Saddam Hussein was captured nearby by the 4th Infantry Division. You wrote the introduction to the new book Hunting Down Saddam. Were you involved in any way with the actual hunt for Saddam Hussein?
No, I wasn't. I was just in the same vicinity of where the capture took place,
and how
working
much,
out of a facility there called the Tikrit Palace.
How much awareness did you have of what was going on? Was it so secret that you didn't really get a wind of it, or did you get a wind of it?
In my capacity as a civilian contractor working in security, I collaborate with the military all the time. If I have information that they could use from some of my workers that are local national Iraqis that are working for us, I share that information with them. Along with that, I attend their, we call them battle update briefs that the military runs every day. And they have these battle update briefs twice a day, and they talk about missions that they have completed and missions to come. And most of the information that's given at these battle update briefs are classified, and the targets that they go after are classified. So you kind of have to read the tea leaves of what they're trying to do. So, yes, I kind of was in the know because I was reading the tea leaves and saying, yeah, I know who they're going after next.
What was the reaction in Tikrit after Saddam Hussein's capture?
Once it was made public, which was the next day when Secretary Bremer released that information, and the Iraqi radio stations started broadcasting it, the Tikritis around Tikrit themselves were elated. They began celebratory fire, shooting their weapons up in the air, which can become dangerous at times. The workers that were working for me at the time were told, and they were smiling. They were very happy and hugging each other, and kept showing us some of the torture marks that Saddam's regime had done to them. So they were very, very happy.
Would you describe your job as Kellogg Brown & Root's security manager in Tikrit?
What I do is I collaborate with the military and make sure that our security is in collusion with each other. I give them information I give them the weaknesses that we have and ask them for help in certain areas, one being convoy security. We have to travel with a military convoy to protect our civilians. We cannot travel outside of a military installation when we're trying to provide services to the military. We have to travel in a convoy, an armed convoy. That's one of the aspects of my job. The other one is to ensure that our resources that we're providing to the military are protected physically. We provide a certain degree of protection ourselves, and then we expect the military to help us in accordance with a contract. They are to provide force protection for us. So that's kind of the two biggest areas that I work with the military on.
What are the greatest threats? What are the things you've successfully prevented from happening? What are the greatest threats on the horizon?
I believe the greatest threat to the coalition forces, and when I say that coalition forces, that encompasses all the military representatives representing the coalition, to include civilian contractors from each of the countries.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest threat is, again, the failure of the Iraqi democratization, if you will, to show the Iraqi people that we're there to help them rebuild their country and get them on a road to democracy. And the threat can come in many forms. now, there is a...
Are you saying there that some of the Iraqis see you as the bad guys when you see yourselves as the good guys, and there hasn't been enough work to change their perception? Is that what you're saying?
More or less. One of the things we're trying to do is employ more Iraqis,
mm-hmm.
and to get them employed, to get them to start bringing food to their tables, and not to see us as somebody that's here to take their oil. And there was a myth, and there still are people believing that. But I think they see above that. And what we have to do as part of the coalition force, we have to show them that we're here to stay, and we're not going to abandon them like we did, like some groups did in Afghanistan. We're here to help them rebuild and see them through the end. We're not here to take their oil.
You spent 22 years in the military. Now you're with a private company in Iraq. Is there anything regulating the kind of weapons you're allowed to use? What kind of weapons can you use as head of security for Kellogg Brown and Root?
Well, most of us do not have weapons.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we rely on the military for our protection. And just recently, I switched jobs. I now work out of Baghdad, and one of the capacities I do is oversee the executive protection details for some of our VIPs. And with that, I do get to carry a weapon, but I normally try not to get out there, because that's why we have an executive protection detail, to go out there and take the risk. So there's only a few of us that really have weapons, and that's more or less for self-protection, not for to be offensive with it like the military would be.
How does post-war Iraq look in Baghdad compared to how it looked into Crete?
Well, I think the people of Baghdad are anxious to get back to a normal life, which most of them have never knew. The infrastructure seems to be moving right along. You can see hotels being rebuilt. You can see, the power stations up and running to almost 100% capacity, where before, even during the Saddam regime, they were probably at 70% capacity. And I think the people are very excited, but the majority, 70% of them, as was quoted by some news media folks just recently, they want to see change. They want to be able to take control of their own country. You know, they want us out of there. I mean, what country wants a foreign military power inside of it, controlling them as soon as possible? But at the same time, they know that they cannot progress unless they get law and order established and end depression between some of these groups.
Now, you were in the military for 22 years. Why did you decide to go into a private military company after that?
Well, I saw a lot of opportunity there. Before I retired out of the military, I finished my master's in business management, and I kind of wanted to go into a private company and use some of those skills. And part of it was just the opportunity to continue to work overseas. And being in special forces for over 20 years, you get injured a lot. And I've had a fractured ankle from a parachute jump. I've had three knee surgeries. I've been shot in the leg before. I had a dose of melanoma, a bad shoulder. So, you know, I can go down a laundry list of why, you know, it comes a point in time in somebody's career, hey, it's time to give it up and go do something that's not as risky. But my foot is in my mouth for where I'm working now. But
sure.
The physical part of it was part of the decision I made.
You meant your heart is in your mouth, right?
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyways, the physical issues have played a big part in retiring from the military. But a lot of people after that would want to just go to a safe setting, you know, maybe an easy security job in the U.S. or something. You hardly went that route.
Well, you know, I started out working for, we were called Brown & Root back then in 1999, in the Balkans, in Macedonia, and then eventually Bosnia. It was pretty much a safe environment, providing services to the military. And I did that for a year, and after that I worked for Department of Defense for 3 years as an anti-terrorism officer. And I guess after doing 3 years of that, people know me, they know my reputation in the civilian industry, not just Department of Defense. And, you know, I got quite a few job offers to come back on board. And that's why I'm in Baghdad right now working for KBR, because, you know, people know me and, you know, they offer me, you know, money has something to do with it, of course. You know, you take a risk in life, and one of those risks is your job. But to me, I don't see it as as what the media portrays it as. They target Americans, and you know, all Iraqis are against America. That's not true. There's probably less than 1% out there that are part of these terrorist groups that are part of the insurgency. And part of my natural upbringing through the military was to win the hearts and minds of people, of indigenous people that I would work with in those Middle Eastern countries that I've been to. And I just thought it was a natural thing for me to do is to go help KBR in Iraq.
What's it like to have been part of the military for so long and now be working closely with the military but not be a part of it?
You know, in the beginning, it was, okay, you have to change your way of thinking somewhat. 50% of the people that are part of most of these civilian contractors are former military, or else they cannot just hit the ground running, so to speak, as mm-hmm. most of us can do. So we understand what they're going through. We understand their methodologies, and we can bring something to the table when we sign up and work for these civilian contractors, and the military sees it. And you know, they pick our brains and ask us for, you know, ideas to help improve their situation. And, you know, we open all the doors, anything they want.
Without asking you to necessarily give specific figures, how does the pay compare with a civilian company versus the military?
Well, I guess your salary, depending on what rank you reached in the military, is almost doubled.
Mm-hmm. That's a powerful incentive.
Yes, it is.
My guest is Mark Vargas, a former commander in the Special Forces, who is now working in Baghdad as a security expert for Kellogg Brown and Root. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mark Vargas, a former commander in the Special Forces, who is now working in Baghdad as a security expert for Kellogg Brown and Root. He wrote the introduction for the new book, Hunting Down Saddam. Who do you answer to? Do you answer to the military or to KBR? And just KBR, do you answer to KBR and do they answer to the military? Like, what's the chain of command like?
That's exactly right. You got it right on the nose. I answer, you know, within my own chain of command and KBR and the head people answer to the military.
How do you dress? Do you dress in a military uniform or in a military-type uniform so that you have the authoritative look that the uniform provides, or would that make you too much of a target?
Well, we're not allowed to wear uniforms, and that's one of the stipulations of the contract, because we're not combatants.
Right.
We don't consider ourselves combatants, so we wear civilian clothes.
So what do you typically wear?
I can, you know, depending on the occasion, I can wear anything from, you know, a dress slacks to a collared shirt. And, all, you know, if I'm going on a detail, sometimes I might wear blue jeans and a T-shirt with a vest to hold magazines and things like that.
Is it a bulletproof vest?
Yeah, we all wear bulletproof vests, just like the military does, and helmets when we go outside of the hotel.
I'm going to assume that you would have found it difficult to return to civilian life back home in the United States when you retired from the military, because you've remained in war zones through private companies. What is so hard, after having served in the Special Forces for so long, about the idea of returning to a kind of quiet, safe civilian life in the U.S.?
Well, I had that life. I lived in Coral Springs, Florida, and I was working for United States Southern Command, which is based out of Miami, Florida. And then later I took a job with 5th Corps, which is out of Heidelberg, and I worked there for 3 years. So, you know, the job... Is all these jobs are analytical. You know, you use your brain more than you use your brawn. And of course, I probably at this point in my life, I like to use my brain more than my brawn, because, you know, my body is falling apart. But you know, I still find it exciting to be in the know, and to be in the know, you have to be there.
Do you have a family?
Yes, I do.
And are they in the U.S. or in Baghdad?
They're in the U.S.
Do they worry about you a lot?
Of course.
Is it hard to be separated by your work like that?
Yes, it is. It's very hard. You know, I've been married almost 14 years, and my wife has known nothing but Special Forces and deployments and deployment after deployment and spending, you know, 3 months out of the year at home. And of course, once I retired, I did it for a year, and she wasn't very happy. And I took a job with Department of Defense for the last 3 years. And we had a great life, and we still do. You know, I could take a break any time I want, and it's not like I'm stuck there forever. I can take a break every 4 months or every 2 months and meet her somewhere. This is not, you know, a career that's going to go on, I can tell you that. It's something that I wanted to do. You know, maybe I'll just do it for a year. My year's up in July,
mm-hmm.
and then I'll go back to a normal life.
Right. So you say.
So I say.
One last question, and this might strike you as a little goofy, but since you've sustained so many injuries in all your years with the Special Forces, how do you deal with pain? Is pain hard for you to deal with? Can you just, like, put that in the background, or is that the kind of thing that that you find very distracting?
Well, I call it herbs and vitamins. That's how I deal with pain. And I think I have more headaches now than I ever had because I'm using, you know, my brain more than anything else. But
you mean literal headaches?
Literal headaches, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's some of the sulcus is growing. You know, I'm using the left part of my brain more than I ever used it before. So.
And it hurts.
It hurts.
Well, good luck to you, and thank you very much for talking with us.
It was very nice to have this opportunity, Terry. Thank you.
Mark Vargas is a security expert for Kellogg Brown & Root. He's now based in Baghdad. He wrote the introduction to the new book, Hunting Down Saddam, by Robin Moore. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Shorrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback by Eric Larson, Devil in the White City, Murder, Magic, and Madness at the Fair That Changed America. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, the Left Behind series of novels about the apocalypse and the second coming of Jesus Christ. It's become a publishing phenomenon. Bookstores have already purchased nearly 2 million copies of the final novel, which is about to be published. We'll hear from co-author Tim LaHaye. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.